Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be David Carr. He is the chief brand Cebador of Guayaki. And Guayaki makes fair trade yerba mate. And I will tell you more about the company and more about David when he comes on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the area, share my weekly recipe with you, and tell you some ways that you might want to take some action this week. So first off, I've been talking about this for months, and it's finally coming here tomorrow. August 23rd is the NOFA New York Gala up in Poughkeepsie, New York. And NOFA New York stands for the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And New York is our local chapter. And we are having a Climate of Change Gala, which is an evening of inspiring speakers, farm-to-table dinner, open bar, silent and live auctions. And they have a great lineup of speakers. Isabella Rosalini will be the featured speaker. She's a filmmaker and organic farmer. Scott Chasky from the Peconic Land Trust and Quail Hill Farm will be our master of ceremonies. And also Onika Abramson will be there from Schoolyard NYC. So it will be great. A great event, and I believe there's still some tickets. So if you are interested, go to the NOFA New York website and join us. Some other things coming up. Soil Saturdays are starting up August 31st at Hawthorne Valley Biodynamic Farm. That's in Ghent, New York. September 8th is the 13th annual North Fork Foodie Tour, which is a self-guided tour of all these wonderful farms and organic producers on the North Fork. And you can find links to all of these things on my website at iegreen.com. September 13th and 14th is the 5th annual Food Lab, which takes place out at Stony Brook University Southampton campus. And it's Friday evening and all day Saturday. And they have a great lineup of speakers, so check that out. Orchestri Farm, which is the farm that I have been supporting for a while, they do great work. They are an organic CSA farm that works with young adults on the spectrum. They are having their Harvest Moon, an evening of expressive agriculture, on September 14th. And that should be a wonderful event as well. And then, of course, the annual Coalition for Healthy School Foods Gala is coming up this year, which is the first year they're actually having it as a comedy night. And that should be a lot of fun. It's at the Academy of Medicine in New York City. I'm there every year. I have a table serving up some vegan food, but all the food, lots of vendors. It's all vegan. It's beautiful. The Coalition for Healthy School Food is responsible for really encouraging plant-based food in New York City schools and across the country, and there actually are 3 completely vegetarian schools now in New York City. So that's really exciting, and they also were big promoters of the campaign for Meatless Mondays. So all of New York City now is meatless on Mondays, and I know that's something that I'm really trying to push through in Glen Cove schools, where I'm the farm-to-school coordinator. So I'm really excited about that. Soil Saturdays continue up at Hawthorne Valley Farm on September 28th, and that should be great. And then the New York Times is having their annual food festival October 5th and 6th in Bryant Park. And depending on whether you just want to go to the speakers or you want to go to the open park and check out the vendors, prices fluctuate. So you can either go to the New York Times Food Festival or find a link on my website. All really great things to do. So I was part of a very interesting conversation that I just want to bring up here that, you know, is on my mind. It's a conversation that has come up quite a bit in food, the food circles. I know as part of NOFA New York's work this year, we all were asked to read the book Farming While Black in America. And the conversation that's going on right now is about the farmers market from Bloomington, Indiana, that's been in the news over the last couple of weeks about the farmers market. There's a couple there that have a stand at the farmers market, and it's been known that they are white supremacists. You know, they post onto websites that are in alignment with an anti-racist movement, and there are people at the farmers markets that just want those people out. And then, of course, you have the other side where people say, well, there's freedom of speech. They're not at the farmers market advocating their views. But then the conversation comes back around saying, well, if you don't stand up against someone who's racist, then you're kind of supporting them. You know, that to actually try to move this conversation forward, we all need to become anti-racists so that we are really aligning ourselves with a movement to break down the barriers of racism. Just like, you know, this came up, you know, years ago with all the bullying that was going on. And, you know, if you might not be the person doing the bullying, but if you're standing by and watching someone bully someone else and you're not doing anything, you're just as guilty. Well, it's the same thing with racism. If you are aware that someone is a racist and they are advocating agenda that you don't agree with, well, it's your job to speak up against it. We need to all take that stand and stand in solidarity with all the marginal groups, whether it's people of color, whether it's indigenous tribes, whether it's gay, lesbian, bisexual, whether it's women, whether it's immigrants, whatever the subgroup is, we all need to stand up against bigotry, against prejudice. You know, there's just no room in our world for that. And in the food movement, this conversation has been coming up a lot. I know it's also, you know, I have friends that are midwives, and it's coming up in the midwifery groups. You know, the outlook for people of color, mortality rate is much higher than it is for white folks. You know, just everything in our society is not created equal, and it needs to be. And we all need to work towards making it so. And so this conversation that I was a part of was really getting hot, where, you know, people were on, you know, coming at it from both sides, you know, First Amendment, freedom of speech, you know, we all, you know, acknowledge that. But when it's putting other people down at the expense of other people, it's just not okay. And so, you know, I took a stand. I want to commit myself to being an anti-racist and an anti-white supremacist. And I'm sure I have learning to do to really stand in solidarity with those groups and to really, you know, take a look at, you know, my white privilege that I grew up with. I mean, yes, I am also Jewish, and I know, you know, people in my history have dealt with anti-Semitism and, you know, relatives in the Holocaust and all of that. So I'm not immune to prejudice. But I don't wear it on my sleeve. You know, people can't look at me and know unless I choose to tell them. So it's different when you are a person of color or an immigrant from another country. So we all need to really take a stand and, you know, and join our brothers and sisters in harmony, spread the love, push for good food, access to good food for everybody, and, you know, and spread the love. But the conversation that I was witness to was certainly not that. So, anyway, I would like to share my recipe with you. It is an eggplant and tomato curry. And, you know, I have so many eggplants and tomatoes coming out of the garden right now. When I made this recipe a few weeks ago, I did not have access to my fresh tomatoes. So now, instead of the canned fire-roasted tomatoes that I put in this recipe, I maybe would use some fresh tomatoes. But I'll let you all decide that. You know, one of the beauties of when you are the chef and you are the one in the kitchen you get to make the choices, and you are the boss, as my niece once said. So you can choose and substitute what you need to substitute to meet what you need to meet. So I started with a quarter cup of olive oil, one tablespoon scraped finely chopped fresh ginger root, 4 teaspoons finely chopped garlic, 1 onion chopped or sliced, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon ground cumin, 1/2 teaspoon coriander, 1/2 teaspoon cardamom, 1 teaspoon turmeric, 1 carrot cut into bite-sized pieces, 3 Japanese eggplants, ends removed, cut lengthwise, and then on the angle into chunks, 2 cups broccoli that you're going to break up into florets, 1 can of the diced fire roasted tomatoes with chili. Those are the spicy ones that I get at Trader Joe's. But this is where I said you can use fresh tomatoes if you want, and you can add some chili peppers to this if you would like it to still have some spice. I used 1/4 cup of water, 1 teaspoon of garam masala, and then 2 tablespoons of chopped parsley or fresh cilantro. And I started in a large wok. I heated the oil over medium-high heat, and then I added the onions. Then I stirred in the ginger and the garlic, and I cooked that for a few minutes. And then I added the carrots and the salt. I lowered the heat and stirred constantly, frying the onions and carrots for 7 to 8 minutes until they were soft and caramelized. Then I added the eggplant, the cumin, the coriander, the cardamom, and the turmeric. And I cooked that for another 5 minutes. And if the vegetables start sticking to the wok, you can add a little water. That's what the water's for. And that's really a nice way to, you know, keep it from sticking, to deglaze the pan without adding more water. And then I let that cook down for another few minutes. Then I added the broccoli and the canned tomatoes and cooked that for another 5 minutes. And then I added the garam masala and mixed that in well. And covered the wok and let that cook down for about 10 minutes. Then I tasted it. You know, you want to make sure that the eggplant's really cooked well. That's really important. And then taste it for the seasonings, and you can adjust the seasonings according to your taste buds. So if you used fresh tomatoes instead of the canned, you're going to want to add some red pepper flakes at this time to make it a little spicier. And that's it. It's delicious. You can garnish it with fresh cilantro or parsley. And I served it with some saffron rice. So you can also serve it with quinoa or garlic mashed potatoes, really whatever you'd like. So that was that recipe, and it was really, really wonderful. So enjoy. If you make the recipe, please let me know how you like it. And I love feedback on my recipes. So anyway, it is now my pleasure to introduce my guest today, David Carr. He is the chief brand Sebador, which is the maker of yerba mate. And he co-founded this company with his soul brother, Alex Pryor. And they did that in 1996. And Guayaki makes organic fair trade yerba mate. And they have an innovative business model called market-driven regeneration, in which Guayaki serves as a bridge linking consumer purchases of healthy yerba mate products in North America with indigenous communities engaged in sustainable agriculture and reforestation projects in Argentina, Paraguay, and Brazil. And as the brand steward, David's responsible for the look, feel, and story of Guayaki, including all media, marketing, and retail activities. Guayaki's vision is that yerba mate culture will empower the market-driven regeneration business model to regenerate ecosystems and create vibrant communities. David's is committed to creating sustainable, regenerative enterprises that nourish the planet and humanity. And his work at Guayaki expanded to include Come to Life Productions, which creates films that feature people who are living their passions while creating positive change for humanity and the planet. And David lives in British Columbia with his wife and his two boys. David, are you with me?
I'm with you.
Great. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on your program.
Sure. So how's the weather up there in British Columbia right now?
Well, it's our summertime, so it's pretty amazing. It's that, you know, warm during the day. It's just starting to cool off towards the end of August in the evenings, but it's uh-huh. lovely. I was out paddleboarding this morning. It's awesome. Lovely.
So for those of my listeners who don't know what yerba mate is, can you first start us off by telling us what yerba mate is?
Yeah, for sure. It's most easily understood as a leaf from a tree that's brewed, probably more similar to coffee, but much like coffee and tea, and consumed as an energizing beverage. You know, oftentimes in the morning, people will brew mate hot in a French press or a coffee maker, and like coffee, they might add a sweetener and some milk to make a mate latte. That's how a lot of people enjoy it. And then it can also be enjoyed cold, as we sell our cans and bottles in the marketplace, where it's first brewed hot and then it's iced down. In all cases, people usually drink it in place of coffee or tea, or in addition to coffee or tea if they're looking for a different kind of stimulation.
Mm-hmm. And is it usually drunk with a straw?
Well, if you're in South America, where the beverage is native to, you know, it grows in the forests of Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil, and they've been drinking it for hundreds of years out of a traditional mate gourd. It's actually a squash-like vessel, so it's round, and you hold it in your hand and you pass it around and you share it amongst friends, usually. And you put the loose yerba mate in the vessel, and then you drink it through like a filter straw. Usually they're metal. Sometimes they're made out of different things like bamboo or ceramic or anything, or glass even. But the ones that I'm accustomed to using are metal, usually stainless steel, and they have little slits down the bottom, and that's the part, the tip of the bombilla, it's called, goes into the loose yerba mate, and then as you draw the water through the bombilla, the little slits in the metal filter out the leaf material and the tender stems, which are part of the brew, and you just draw in the liquid.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I've seen people drink it. You know, I'm a coffee drinker, so I'm not as familiar with it, but I've certainly seen people drinking through those straws all the time now.
Yeah, and it's really popular. I mean, once you drink it that way, you often want to drink it that way. I drink it that way. I drink it that way today. Most days I drink it out of a gourd in the morning because I enjoy, you know, the ritual of getting my thermos, you know, prepared with the right temperature. I usually put ginger in my thermos and steep really strong ginger water in my thermos, and then I pour the water through my mate like all morning. So I might sip a mate for an hour. I might sip it with friends or whatever, but it's how I like to enjoy it in the morning. Probably more common is people brewing it in a French press or a coffee maker to get a really strong brew, because you can brew more of it at once and have like a single cup and have it very strong, whereas the gourd, it's more of a slow release, so you would drink it over a period of time, and every time you fill it, you're drinking like a shot worth, so maybe an ounce or two of liquid, and then you fill the thermos. If you take the thermos and you refill the gourd, you know, and that's how it works.
Mm-hmm. And what health properties does yerba mate have other than other caffeinated plants?
Well, the health benefits are many, and I think that's how a lot of people find yerba mate, is that, you know, coffee has, you know, hasn't really worked out that well for them. It might be hard on their system for one reason or another. And so people are often led to mate because they hear it's a gentle form of stimulation, or it has a lot of antioxidants, which it does. They say they don't even know of another plant that has as many antioxidants, so it's really good for that. It's really good for your immune system. You know, energetically, it's anything that it deals with your digestion or energy levels, yerba mate seems to work really well for most people. It's loaded with vitamins and minerals and amino acids as well, so they've often referred to it as like a liquid vegetable.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? I didn't know it had amino acids as well. Okay.
Yeah, there's even studies that show that...
And it does have caffeine, you said?
people have lived on it because it has enough like proteins to sustain you for a period of time.
Wow. Wow. Very cool. So tell us a little bit about you and how you came to found Guayaki, and where does the name come from?
Yeah, well, that, there's two questions there. So the name was already... So when I first was introduced to the product, it was coming from, you know, we sourced mate from a single source in Paraguay, and rather than today, like most of our mates from Brazil and Argentina and Paraguay. Well, when we first started sourcing from a project in Paraguay, there were indigenous people living near where the mate was growing, and they were referred to as the Guayaki people, and so we just ended up using that name. It turned out to be a kind of a difficult name, but in the end, it stuck, and that's where it came by the name. But I first met mate by way of introduction from my really good friend Alex Pryor, who shared it with me about 25 years ago. You know, he invited me over for a meal, and then, you know, after a meal, it was not uncommon to share a mate gourd. And I, you know, sipped the gourd for the first time, and I had a really profound physiological experience from it. For me, I was someone who suffered most of my life from pretty extreme allergies, hay fever, you know, growing up in California. And I had taken a lot of different pharmaceutical drugs like Benadryl and Sudafed most of my life. And even before that, I had got shots in my arms for over a decade to, like, you know, modulate my allergies. And so I lived with hay fever most of my life. And when I drank the mate for the first time with Alex, really strong out of the gourd, I immediately felt better, and I could breathe better, and my head cleared up. And so I was really curious, like, what is this stuff? How come I've never heard of it before? And every time we got together and drank mate, the same thing would happen. And so I came to it more because of, like, personal regeneration. I was feeling it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so you haven't had problems with your allergies since?
You know, my allergies have gotten less and less over the years. Yeah, every time I drink mate, I definitely can breathe better and my head clears up. It's known for that. You know, a lot of people use mate for that reason because it does. Later on, I learned more about why, but, it, you know, they call it a bronchio and vasodilator, so it definitely opens up your breathing passageways. And then I also believe, you know, I've heard from many people that it balances your blood sugar levels. I think they even define it as an anti-diabetic. So I think part of it is just the health properties of drinking a product that's balancing for your blood sugar, and also is a vasio and bronchio dilator. I think it just helps you breathe better and clears your mind.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And let's talk a little bit about your idea about the company, your business model. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how you came up with that?
Sure. Well, yerba mate, you know, is a really popular drink in the southern cone of South America, and it comes originally from the Atlantic rainforest, which, you know, is a area that is now very endangered. There's only about 7% of it that remains. And yerba mate being endemic to that forest, it turns out you can grow it in the forest and it becomes a sustainable income vehicle for not only the forest, but the people who live there. However, if you look at it, like, most of the mate is grown in large plantations in direct sunlight for massive yields because it's such a widely consumed product. So very few people even know it originally came from the forest, but they grow it, you know, in thousands of acres at a time and in direct sunlight. And what it does is it makes it grow faster so you get a bigger yield, but the flavor is sacrificed and the quality all around. So if you grow it in the forest, you get a higher quality product that has a smoother flavor, it's less bitter, and ultimately, you know, is grown in better soils. And so the whole idea was, if we were to create a market demand for a product that was forest grown, then you could create, you know, regeneration systems around the growing of the product. And so that's what we've been working on for the last couple decades.
Mm-hmm. So right now it's all, most of the mate that people are getting is mass produced?
Yeah, well, pretty much all of it, you know. And even amongst that, very little bit is organic. There's just not the awareness in South America. People just grew up drinking mate, so they don't really know. So all commercial yerba mate is mostly sun-grown and grown conventionally, and they often use, you know, major petrochemicals to grow it. So what we're bringing to market in a new market that was unfamiliar with it, which is the North American market, is a product that's grown, you know, in its natural forest-shaded environment, you know, organically, and it just has a way better feeling in the body and a better taste profile.
Mm-hmm. So have you had to work with indigenous people to help support growing more of it in the forest, or is it just what they've been growing anyway and you're just able to use what is already there?
Yeah, we've had to work with them because it wasn't something they ever grew, right? Like, the forests have just been cut down. I mean, they cut down over 90% of the forests, and so they would just originally just harvest it themselves. And so we're working with indigenous communities in Argentina, in Paraguay and in Brazil mostly to replant mate into forested areas where they've been given some land by the government, where they've been like relocated to. And so we're growing yerba mate in those zones. And then we're also like in Argentina, where we started a regeneration center, we have a demonstration example, a couple hundred acres, where we've taken sun-grown mate, which is most of what you see in Argentina, and started planting fast-growing fruit trees and hardwoods that would eventually cover the mate. And so we started that over 15 years ago, so now we actually have a really good example of how to reforest. So where we started, it was just sun-grown mate, and now it looks like a forest with, you know, rainforest-grown mate growing below the canopy.
Oh, great. And that's in Paraguay and Brazil?
That's happening in all three countries, but our demonstration project where it started sun-grown and turned it into rainforest-grown is in Argentina.
Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Very cool. So can you talk a little bit about regenerative agriculture and what that means? I mean, I know you just gave one perfect example of replanting a forest. But again, for those of my listeners that might not be familiar with regeneration, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, regeneration is multidimensional and it's personal. You know, we think it can also be social and environmental and cultural. And it's even philosophical in terms of how we frame our paradigm of thinking as we evolve from like a dominant extractive mindset to a holistic integrative one. And at Guayaquil, we define regeneration as our capacity to create, nourish, and rewild these interdependent and interconnected ecosystems so they can create more balance and harmony and ultimately abundance. And that's what we're doing. We're finding that as we integrate everything we're doing from the people and the land and the natural systems, we're creating abundance because you're really allowing nature to do most of the work.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then it keeps replenishing so that you don't have to keep replanting each year, right?
That's absolutely. And that was one of the first things that struck me with yerba mate. It seemed like a bit of a green ATM machine because you harvest it once a year. In some places, you can even harvest it twice. And you prune back a lot of the tree, and then it grows back. So you're just harvesting the leaves from the tree, and it's completely sustainable as long as you don't over-harvest and kill the plant. And so you take care of your trees. But, yeah, they just keep producing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, these days we're all so aware of climate change and how climate change is affecting so many areas of our lives. And it's certainly, agriculture is one of the areas where it's really, really going to be problematic down the road. And yet, with regenerative agriculture, there's a little bit of possibility there to, you know, go back to some of these natural systems and help mitigate climate change. Can you talk a little bit how Guayaquil is working to mitigate climate change through their regenerative projects?
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, you hear lots of figures out there, but the last one I heard was even 25% of our carbon emissions are coming from agriculture in general, and so with regenerative agriculture, again, it's more about putting the carbon back in underground. And we understand that you know, forest ecosystems and multi-strata eco-forestry is one of the top ways to put carbon back in the soil, because, you know, the leaves are just basically doing all the work for you all the time as they regrow. They're eating it up. So I think by reforesting, we're doing as much as we possibly can, because that's the basis of our entire business model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why, you know, they've talked so much about how cutting down the rainforest has added to climate change, because we don't have those forests anymore to sequester the carbon from the atmosphere. And, you know, and so the whole idea about regenerative agriculture and going back to planting trees and trying to, you know, sequester some of that carbon, again, we need to, you know, we really need to combat climate change from so many different sides. We can't just think, you know, going back to organic agriculture by itself is going to do it. You know, we really need
to. No, and also what I've heard too, you know, is that younger forests or emerging forests are actually sequestering more carbon than mature forests, because they're hungry and they're growing like teenagers in a sense. So, you know, like regenerating forests is going to do a lot.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's exciting. You're at the forefront of that. So that's great. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with David Carr. He's the chief brand cebador of Guayaki, which means he is the yerba mate maker at Guayaki. So, David, right before the break, I was asking you about some of the myths or legends you've heard over the years about yerba mate. Can you share us a story?
Yeah, the one I share the most that it really caught my attention early on was the legend of Yari, because so many stories around of yerba mate have been around regeneration. And the one that I recall is, you know, there was the indigenous Guayaki people and the other tribes, the Guarani people, they lived in an area of the forest where they'd kind of clear a small section and they would live there for some period of time. It could be months or a year. But then they would move on, because that's just how they sustainably lived. And one of the myths is, as the tribe was ready to move on and it was traveling, one of the elders fell ill and couldn't keep up with the tribe who was moving to the next spot. And one of the daughters stayed back, Yari, and then, I'm sorry, one of the daughters stayed back, and then Yari came and visited her, the goddess of yerba mate, and she shared with her how to prepare the yerba mate, and, you know, in the vessel, and drink it through the bombilla, as we talked about earlier. And then the elder was then consumed the yerba mate, and his energy came back, and he was able to catch up with the tribe. So it's a lot of those stories, and I definitely resonate with those regeneration myths, because I feel like that is the story that I hear from people the most as well, who've been consuming the product for years.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk to us a little bit about Come to Life, the project that you have that has emerged out of Guayaki?
Sure, yeah. Come to Life Media is all focused on telling the regenerative stories that are taking place on there that are beyond just Guayaki and yerba mate. You know, so much, you know, we're almost 25 years in, and we didn't get that much help in sort of sharing our story. And like a lot of smaller and younger companies, we're so focused on doing the work that you don't really have the bandwidth to do the storytelling, right? So Come to Life Media's vision is to basically step in and tell the story of really exciting regenerative projects that we're tapped into or connected with in some way or other to tell their stories.
Mm-hmm. And how long has that been going on?
It's been going on a couple of years, and it's evolving more and more and getting better and better. But everything that we're doing, people can check out on cometolife.com or check out our Instagram, Come to Life Music. So we work mm-hmm. with a lot of musicians, too, who are singing about the new paradigm and writing lyrics about regeneration and the world we need to create for ourselves. And so those are the people that we're aligning with, because they're doing the same work, but maybe in a different category or a different place.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that impressed me when I met you last month at the event you had hosted in Brooklyn was how you partner with so many other do-good organizations. Can Can you talk a little bit about how you work in partnership with other organizations and how that, you know, the power in numbers and how that working together really helps mobilize all of you in your work?
Yeah, well, it's happened organically over the years. I think first and foremost because I think you have strength in numbers and you don't. When we started almost 25 years ago, we felt pretty alone, right? So as soon as you like run into people who are doing similar work or really resonated with the work we are doing, we wanted to work with them in a capacity that allowed or that made sense. And oftentimes, because we didn't really have the resource or to do much, we would just offer to share yerba mate and sort of energize what they're doing. So more often than not, we're just sharing our product with these different groups to help them on their own path, and they're very appreciative generally because, you know, having complimentary yerba mate at your events is a big deal because it brings the energy of what we're doing to it. And so we've done a lot of that over the years, and then friendships develop, and then as they evolve over time, you hatch new ways to work together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see a lot of that happening with young people working on regenerative models, and it's inspiring to me. You know, I also have been doing this for a really long time, and, you know, I started and I was, you know, when I became an organic chef, I mean, I was the only one I knew, you know? And,
yeah, exactly.
So, what's that?
You get it. Yes, that.
Right. You know, and, I mean, organic vegetables, I mean, you know, I had to start my own food co-op because there weren't organic vegetables available. I've seen it change, and yet I'm still very impressed when I see the collaboration that I see happening nowadays that really didn't happen as much before.
Yeah, I mean, the only places we even sold our yerba mate beginning was natural food stores and, like, co-ops, right? Because there wasn't even any other place that would be open to taking the product. We didn't even have beverages until 8 or 9 years into the business, right? So we just had loose yerba mate and mate tea bags. So we would just go to the co-ops, and they would sell our product. That was it.
Right. And now if people, you know, saw your cans, they would recognize it instantly because they're everywhere.
Yeah, and they can get them in a convenience store or a supermarket, but it wasn't like that in the beginning. It was far from it.
Mm-hmm. So where do you get your inspiration from to keep going?
From a lot of places, mostly from, you know, staying connected to people and place. I mean, for me, if I can funnel my creative energies into something that's making a greater difference beyond myself in the world, I think that inspires me to keep going. I think it would get a bit old if I was only doing something to serve myself. I feel like I've come from privilege, and I grew up with coming, you know, with privilege comes responsibility, and so I've always had that sense that I've had a responsibility to leave the world a better place than when I came in. And it's obviously a pretty challenging time and a dynamic time. It's also a really exciting time. I feel like we're in that inflection point in history where a lot of the decisions that we make over the next couple decades are going to affect many of the generations to come. So it's really exciting and inspiring to be in a position to be able to make a difference. So I'm just inspired about everything that we're doing and really feel like we're just beginning.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Can you share with us how your company has affected the lives of the Guayaki people that, you know, you've named your company after, and any other of the indigenous people that you're working with?
Yeah, actually, this has become more apparent in the last number of years than it was even in the beginning. Because in the very beginning, it must have been over 15, even like closer to 20 years ago when we first started working with the Ashe Guayaki people. Because at the time when we started using the name, we weren't even working with the Ashe Guayaki people. We just were using the name because it was the name that was that we just came up with in the beginning, just to share for the market. And then we were led by an anthropologist to the actual Ashe Guayaki people, and there was one group of them. There's only six groups of them left because they suffered what's been called a terrible genocide, and we don't need to go into that because it's just been the same history, same story from colonialization all over the world. So the one tribe that we were appointed to of the Ashe Guayaki in Paraguay were the most open to working with sort of the outsiders. The other five groups had no interest, and so we met with them and we came up with some plans early on to like start planting some yerba mate in the forest. They were given 20,000 or so acres of land by the Paraguayan government because, you know, basically Paraguay was completely destroyed and there was only little chunks of islands of rainforest left, and they were given one of those chunks, but they had no means of sustaining themselves, so they're just living on this land and they were allowed to hunt and stuff, but they didn't have any way to make money. And we hatched this idea of like, how about we plant, you know, wild, you know, yerba mate in your forest. And so 10 years later, we started harvesting it, which would have probably been around 2010. I can't remember exactly, but it was like seven to eight years ago, we started harvesting it. But every year, the harvest starts getting bigger because the trees, it takes them about a decade to get to harvesting age, and then they start producing more and more. And so now, 15, 20 years in, we've become quite close, and we've been instrumental in having a lot of really positive things happen, things that we actually haven't even paid for, which is the best part of it, because we always saw ourselves as being a economic partner, meaning let's partner in producing a product together. We'll buy the product from you at a fair trade price, and you'll use that money in your life. But then, because of the momentum that the Guayaki people were experiencing working with us, other nonprofits and NGOs then jumped on the bandwagon. And so since then, school has been built, housing's been built, a processing facility to dry the yerba mate on their land is just going into action this year. And the Food Sovereignty Project, and the list goes on, and that's really accelerated in the last like 3 to 4 years. All this has started happening. But with the World Bank and other local NGOs in South America who have wanted to be part of their success, so which is great, and we welcome it. And because we've been in there as an active partner, you know, not only planting yerba mate every year, but also growing their production, now I think they have about 100 acres of yerba mate in maturity, and they're producing a lot. And so it's become quite the income for them on the yerba mate side, where they actually, you know, now they have all these different systems in place that the other tribes have been looking at what's been going on, and now they're coming to us being like, hey, how can we get involved? We see how it's worked with our friends over at the community. And I would say that's been one of the more rewarding things that's happened, is to see the other groups and communities come to us and say they want to work with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great, because that's always, you know, that's the, not the bottom line, but that's, you know, the part that you want to see really take off. You want to see it not just benefit your company, but you want to see it benefit the local indigenous people. So that's really exciting. Now, the trees that you're planting, those are not the yerba mate trees, right? Those are
trees. So here's the deal. In Brazil, like where we work with the Marecas and the Caingan people, in a certain part of the forest, there's a lot of yerba mate trees. They're wild. That's where we get our wild mate from. They're so densely populating the forest where they live that we don't plant them there. That's a different model. We actually just harvest them, and they're on like 30,000 acres. And so in that community, there's a lot of mate. In Paraguay, it's different. The yerba mate trees grow wild in their forest, but they're not very densely populated. So what we've done is we've gone in there with them and densely populated the yerba mate trees in the understory of the rainforest. And that's where the that's where the 100 acres are planted. And years ago, about a study, must have been more than 25 years ago, a study was done by some Canadians, in fact, that they showed that 60% of the bird and mammal species live and travel in the yerba mate plantations. So that gave us the insight that ultimately this work could lead to these areas becoming biological corridors for the birds and mammals to travel in between different areas that have been regenerated. So that's our grand plan as we look forward over the next 50 years, because we look out decades, is to have these different forest ecosystems, regenerated areas that where we're working with different tribes and different communities, whether it's small farmers or indigenous peoples, where we can connect them with biological corridors, because that's really where the magic happens, is where the bird and mammal species can populate and repopulate these areas. And they'll end up, again, doing the work as long as the corridors are there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Does that make sense to you? It's kind of a big concept, but that's what we're working on.
Uh-huh. And so, like, in the Brazil model, where you're just going in and harvesting, are you harvesting in collaboration with them? You know, are they doing the harvesting and you're purchasing it from them, or how does that work in the
In
Brazil
all cases,
model?
They do the harvesting. Even with the small farmers, they do the harvesting. We don't do the harvesting. We more dictate sort of, like, quality control measures, like, you know, around, you know, safety and food, you know, cleanliness, et cetera.
So they have no problem. They have no problem doing business with you.
No. We specifically we don't own the land. We don't do the harvesting. We're the one. We have contracts with them so that they can go out there and rely on us as a partner. That's the big thing when you do the community development work anywhere in the world, is being able to rely on your partners. And so we need to be the ones who can reliably purchase the product so they can count on it year after year. And if you have a sustainable, that's the crux. If you have a sustainable annual income, then you can start to plan your life. Think about it. You know, that's how you and I operate most likely. Like,
right.
You're kind of counting on things to happen so you can plan and live your life. Well, if they don't have that, it's really hard for them to move forward. And so we've been that reliable source of, yes, we'll buy your harvest, and next year we'll buy more.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool. Now, we've all also heard about, when it comes to fair trade and, you know, the slave trade around cocoa and coffee, how are the people that are harvesting the yerba mate treated? How, you know, are they using children? Do you know about that situation?
Well, yeah, it's pretty vigorous work, and so it's mostly adult males that are doing the harvesting, because they are trees, and oftentimes they're climbing up on small step ladders, or even like in Brazil, they're climbing large wild mate trees that are like 80 to 100 feet tall. It's pretty wild. They actually have to put spikes on and go up the tree and, you know, and harvest. That's a different model. But the only time we've had kids is like when I've been down there with my own kids, and we've gone out to plant yerba mate trees together in like solidarity, where my kids and their kids are working together to plant like the little baby mate plants that turn into trees for years.
Uh-huh.
And we go out, it's kind of fun, and we'll spend the day doing that. And the women often will carry out the baby mate plants in these, you know, handmade woven baskets that are really beautiful, actually. And we all go together and work together. But the pruning and the general maintenance and the heavy lifting is mostly done by adult males, if not exclusively.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good to know. So there's no child labor being used here at all.
No. And the other benefit of working in our model, I would say a really big one, we hear about this, is harvesting yerba mate is tough work, and doing it in the sun is even harder. It's hot. And then also doing it where, you know, they've been spraying petrochemicals in the hot sun is even worse. So to harvest yerba mate in its native forest, where it's cool and shaded, you know, and there's no use of petrochemicals, is pretty ideal. It's probably as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So where do you see Guayaki going in 5 years?
Well, like I said, we're looking out decades in terms of our regeneration models and creating our biological corridors to reconnect these giant areas of land. And then in the global market, we're looking at bringing our own product into communities around the world with our, you know, fossil fuel-free fleet, which we're using electric vehicles now to distribute our own product in North America. And we've also started a program to employ the Legion of System Affected, we call it LOTSA, which is people who are formerly incarcerated, giving them an opportunity to get us a job, and which is really hard to do and important work. So we've hired over 100 people who have been formerly incarcerated to drive any one of our 300 vehicles that are, you know, traveling around. And you probably see the electric vehicles in New York if that's where you're located. So mm-hmm. that's our big plan.
That's great. You know, I remember interviewing people from the Grayston Bakery mm-hmm. in the Bronx. They were one of the first
right.
companies that made a commitment to hiring incarcerated people who couldn't get jobs, and, you know, and how that changed, you know, just changes lives, because, you know, people have to believe in people and give people a second chance. Otherwise, they're going to be back on the street, you know. So that's really wonderful. I'm so glad to hear about that. And I remember Grayston Bakery, their big break was when Ben and Jerry started buying their brownies for their mm-hmm. brownie ice cream.
Right.
And that's when that took off. So that's really great. So we're almost out of time. Can you share with my listeners, you know, one tip or piece of advice you'd like to share for those that are starting their own social venture businesses?
Sure. I mean, I generally share people should do something they're very passionate about and commit and just figure it out. And as long as people's personal and professional are aligned, generally the time will become an illusion, and it won't matter how long or how long it takes, because if you love it and you feel connected to something, you know, bigger than yourself, it's all worth it.
Mm-hmm. So find the passion, and everything else will kind of follow, right?
Exactly. That would be my advice.
Yeah. And do you have any events coming up that you want to share with my listeners?
Well, we're doing our next Come to Life marketing campaign in Los Angeles in the month of October, so we'll be doing lots of events so people can tune into what's going on at guayaquil.com to see what's happening, community gatherings and interactive art experiences and action days focused mostly on mm-hmm. social and environmental regenerative work.
Great. And that's going to be in Los Angeles in October?
Yeah, the month of October. Everything will be available, like I said, on our .com for people to check out and see what's happening.
So when you do an event, it's not one event. It's kind of like over a period of a month. You do many different things going on, like you did.
That's the idea. That way we can partner with a lot of different organizations and connect with more communities and share what we're doing. And we've always enjoyed the more personal and, you know, yerba mate is a symbol of hospitality and friendship. So we've always led that way by just coming in and serving up the product and doing things in collaboration with other like-minded, philosophically aligned people. So going to do that in L.A.
That's wonderful. Okay, well, I will share your contact info and your websites on my website so everyone who's listening knows how to reach out and find your product wherever they are. And, David, I want to thank you so much for the work you're doing in the world. It's really great.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to ask more questions about it.
Sure. And everyone listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you again next week, and have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.